Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so I'll continue on with the chapter one in the book Right Mindfulness. And yesterday we left off with the pairing of ardency with compunction, atapi and otapa. So atapi being ardency or diligence, and otapa being fear of the consequences of doing evil. And compunction is the word that Ajahn Jeff is using. And I read one of the suttas from the Itivuttaka, and then there's another sutta to emphasize this point as well. Similarly, from the Itivuttaka, yesterday's reading was Itivuttaka 34, and this one is a selection or excerpt from Itivuttaka 110. If while he is walking there arises in a monk a thought of sensuality, a thought of ill will, or a thought of harmfulness, and those are the say micca sankappa from the Eightfold Path, and he does not quickly abandon, dispel, demolish, or wipe that thought out of existence, then a monk walking with such a lack of ardency and compunction is called continually and continuously lethargic and low in his persistence. And that's similarly if he's standing, sitting, or lying down. But if, while he is walking, there arises in a monk a thought of sensuality, a thought of ill will, or a thought of harmfulness, and he quickly abandons, dispels, demolishes, and wipes that thought out of existence, then a monk walking with such ardency and compunction is called continually and continuously resolute, one with persistence aroused. And similarly, if he's standing, sitting, or lying down. Ardency is thus closely connected with right effort. In fact, it's synonymous with the desire explicit in the definition of right effort and motivated by the discernment of what's skillful and unskillful, the element of right view implicit in that definition. And there's a short sutta excerpt illustrating this point. This is from Saṅyutta 45, sutta number 8. And what is right effort? There is the case where a monk generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of the non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. A monk generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of abandoning of evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen. And a monk generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. And a monk generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, upholds and exerts his intent for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. This, monks, is called right effort. Those are for the monks who spent time in Thailand. That's from that. It always resounds in my mind. Because they do the one of the chants that you normally do, is the chant of the Eightfold Path, and Chandang Janiti Vayamati Viliyangarapati Jitang Vaganhati Jitpatahati. Yeah, you get used to chanting that.
Sounds like, just from reading the Pali now, those are Ajahn Chah's translations of the first three basics of success, is it?
That's a stock phrase from the suttas describing right effort, and it's chandang janiti vayamati, so that vayama chanda, so arousing, generating desire, vayamati, endeavors, chandang janiti vayamati, viriyangarapati is that arousing persistence. Jitang paganhati, and then upholds and exerts his intent. So there are aspects of
chanda, weary, and chitta, the first three phases.
It's in every one, right? Mindfulness in the noble eightfold path chant.
Right. Yeah, I know that, but I'm just also.
Yeah. What it also taught. Yeah, you see how many of these lists.
Yeah.
They're kind of, but yeah, the first three of the four bases of success, chanda, virya, citta, and then vimamsa. Okay. It's worth noting here the centrality of desire in right effort. As Anguttara 10, Sutta number 58, observes, all phenomena are rooted in desire. This observation applies to skillful as well as to unskillful phenomena. Without skillful desire, it would be impossible to develop the path. And that's from... is referencing Sangyutta 51, Sutta number 15. This means that the path is not a truth available to passive observation. So I thought I'd read both those suttas. Anguttara 10, 58 is actually... It's something like the novice's catechism or something that you learn, you're supposed to learn this. 1058. Bhikkhus, wanderers of other sects may ask you, 1, in what friends are all things rooted? 2, through what do they come into being? 3, from what do they originate? 4, upon what do they converge? 5, by what are they headed? 6, what exercises authority over them? 7, what is their supervisor? 8, what is their core? 9, in what do they culminate? 10, what is their consummation? If you are asked thus, how would you answer them? And the monks are quite rightly sort of said. Bhante, our teachings are rooted in the Blessed One, guided by the Blessed One. Take recourse in the Blessed One. It would be good if the Blessed One would clear up the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will retain it in mind. Then, listen, bhikkhus, and attend closely. I will speak. Yes, Bhante, those bhikkhus replied, the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, if wanderers of other sects should ask you, blah, 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 what are all things rooted in, go through, you should answer them as follows. Friends, all things are rooted in desire. Two, they come into being through attention. Three, they originate from contact. Four, they converge upon feeling. Five, they are headed by concentration. Six, mindfulness exercises authority over them. Seven, wisdom is their supervisor. Eight, liberation is their core. Nine, they culminate in the deathless. Ten, their consummation is Nibbana. If you are asked thus, bhikkhus, it is in such a way that you should answer those wanderers of other sects. So, it's a nice kind of handy list of things that are actually quite important and central.
Quick question on that. In this context, what is headed by referring to?
Headed by is headed by. What is there? They're headed by concentration. Have to.
Law phenomena, samadhi's foremost.
10:58. I'll see if Ajahn, if it's in. If it's translated, then the Pali will be here. There we are. Well, actually, that's another way of looking at it as well. See, it's comparing translations. So it would be what is headed by five. The way that Ajahn Jeff has translated that is all phenomena have concentration as their presiding state. And that. Which is okay, mukha, kimpa mukha, yeah, sort of mouth. Yeah, where's it? Yeah, where's the entry point? Yeah, entry point. Yeah. Yeah, mukha is sort of like an entry point. Okay. Okay. Well, you asked. But that's what I mean. Again, it's helpful to be finding these, one, the expressions that how they're translated and how the comes back to what the Buddha himself said. And sometimes you get a feel for that. And then the next sutta is illustrating that point of without skillful desire, it would be impossible to develop the path. And this is Samyutta 51, Sutta number 15. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Venerable Ananda was dwelling at Kosambi in Gosita's park. Then the Brahmin Unaba approached the Venerable Ananda and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Venerable Ananda, For what purpose, Master Ananda, is the holy life lived under the ascetic Gotama? It is for the sake of abandoning desire, Brahman, that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One. But, Master Ananda, is there a path, is there a way for the abandoning of this desire? There is a path, Brahman, there is a way for the abandoning of this desire. But, Master Ananda, what is the path, what is the way for the abandoning of this desire? Here, Brahman, a bhikkhu develops the basis for spiritual power. This is the Iddipadas. There we go. Get a plug in for them. Develops the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to desire and volitional formations of striving. He develops the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to energy. and in concentration due to mind, concentration due to investigation and volitional formations of striving. This Brahman is the path, this is the way for the abandoning of this desire. Such being the case, Master Ananda, the situation is interminable, not terminable. It is impossible that one can abandon desire by means of desire itself. Well then, Brahman, I will question you about this matter. Answer as you see fit. What do you think, Brahman? Did you earlier have the desire, I will go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding desire subside? Yes, sir. Did you earlier arouse energy thinking, I will go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding energy subside? Yes, sir. Did you earlier make up your mind, I will go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding resolution subside? Yes, sir. Did you earlier make an investigation, shall I go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding investigation subside? Yes, sir. It is exactly the same, Brahman. With a bhikkhu who is an arahant, one whose taints are destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. He earlier had the desire for the attainment of arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding desire subsided. He earlier had the aroused energy, for the attainment of arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding energy subsided. He earlier had made up his mind to attain arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding resolution subsided. He earlier made an investigation for the attainment of arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding investigation subsided. What do you think, Brahman? Such being the case, is the situation terminable or interminable? Surely, Master Ananda, such being the case, the situation is terminable, not interminable. Magnificent, Ananda. From today, let Master Ananda remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. So it's a good illustration of that that aspect of there needs to be some kind of desire formulated in the mind, and that's where that sort of like the in the Four Noble Truths, the cause of suffering is desire, and then that sense, oh, I can't have any kind of desire whatsoever, and trying to eliminate all kinds of desire, or somehow that one can not have to put forth any kind of effort whatsoever, just effortless, desireless freedom ends up being kind of a space cadet. It's kind of amorphous jelly blob somewhere. So there needs to be that skillful desire, and again to reread that. It's worth noting here the centrality of desire in right effort, and then as that first sutta from the Anguttara observes, all phenomena are rooted in desire. This observation applies to skillful as well as to unskillful phenomena. Without skillful desire, it would be impossible to develop the path, as just illustrated by that last sutta. This means that the path is not a truth available to passive observation. It's a truth of the will, something that can become true only if you want it to happen. By applying the desire of right effort, the element of skillful purpose, to the act of remaining focused, ardency enables sati to be established as right sati. Taken together, these mental factors of sati, alertness, and ardency indicate that right sati, as a factor in the path to the end of suffering and stress, brings memories from the past to bear on a clear alertness of events and actions in the present with the purpose of abandoning unskillful qualities and developing skillful ones, both in the present and on into the future. In this way, alertness and ardency ensure that right sati points not only in one direction, to the past, but to all three directions of time at once, past, present, and future. When, in the 19th century, T.W. Rhys Davids encountered the word sati while translating Digha Nikaya 22 into English, that's the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, he tried to find an English term that would convey this meaning of memory applied to purposeful activity in the present. Concluding that English didn't have an adequate equivalent, he made up his own, mindfulness. This, of course, wasn't a total invention. In fact, Rhys Davids' choice was apparently inspired by the phrasing of the Anglican prayer to be ever mindful of the needs of others. That is, to always keep their needs in mind. Rhys Davids simply turned the adjective into a noun. Although the term mindfulness has its origins in a Christian context, and although its meaning has ironically become so distorted over the past century, its original meaning serves so well in conveying the Buddhist sense of memory applied to the present that I will continue to use it to render sati for the remainder of this book. Is there any questions?
Isn't it somewhere where the Buddha is quoted as saying, I teach path application of effort?
Yes. Yeah. It's actually, it's a Viryavada. It's a path of effort. I mean, it's also interesting that, say, in the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, which is kind of a compilation of all the of many of the critical teachings. It's also what the Buddha. It comes up most often toward the end of the Buddha's life, in particular in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha goes and toward the end of his life. He's going around and he's meeting all the different communities, and he's emphasizing these 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. These are this is the template for practice and training. And out of those 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the quality that appears most often is something to do with effort. I think there's nine. It appears in nine different places, so that it's like the idipada, the chanda, wirya, effort, the indriyas, saddha, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. So virya, the bhalas, the same thing, the eightfold paths, the four, of course, the four right efforts. So that virya comes up in many places. Actually, pretty much in all of them. I think in every single one, because it's the four idipadas, the four right efforts, five indriyas, the five powers, seven factors of enlightenment, eightfold path.
Four
satipatthanas. Four satipatthanas. Yeah, it doesn't. Not quite. Is it? Yeah. But anyway, so that one sees the kind of the central. Of course, it's so important to recognize the, say, right effort is different than kind of scattered and tense effort. That right effort has a balance to it, an internally kind of balanced way of uplifting the mind.
Could you just maybe make a comment about the? It seems like virya and vayama are used very similarly.
Yes.
Any way of pointing out any subtle distinction or how they relate to each other? Or?
No idea.
Just my own experience, what I've just been saying is effort or energy or whatever you want to call it seems to be kind of rooted somewhere, like depending on where it's rooted, just like a simple example would be like, if there's like if things are kind of rooted around, let's say, wanting to become something, wanting to avoid something, then that energy or effort that comes from that seems to not be so useful. Whereas it's like, in other words, like the energy seems to be kind of like, it doesn't seem to be kind of comes out of nowhere.
So, well, it's just like this that sutta view, rooted in desire. So that there's, of course, then there's skillful desire and unskillful desire. A wholesome desire, unwholesome desire.
Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Like, those wholesome desires and unwholesome desires seem to kind of be rooted in something. They don't seem to kind of come from nothing.
He brings it back to that as that's what the desire is. Our desire is what you're, this is where it's rooted. This is, of course, then it's up to, because these things all interrelate. Then it's up to discernment, investigation to sort of see, okay, how do I support a wholesome desire and how do I relinquish an unwholesome desire? How do I temper that? How do I direct it in a skillful way? How do I direct desire? And of course, you can only do that by reflecting on results or the underlying nature of it, in that sense that, okay, this effort is tying me up in knots. What's the underlying desire? Maybe the desire is wrong. So then you're having to reflect on how the interaction between the two, how they tie together.
So it's a lot. It seems like what you're saying, like a lot of it is about just. I mean, there's going to be all these kind of desires, some wholesome, some unwholesome, depending on our sort of discernment and sati. We're going to be able to see it more clear than not.
Yeah.
We just have to kind of keep watch over and keep playing with it and keep.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the sort of the kind of the crux of say practice and training, is that we're. Hopefully, we're learning something.
So it comes to mind the terminability of Ajahn Chah, looking for an end.
Right.
Unskillful desires, you just go around in circles.
Yes, yes, yes.
Act upon a desire, feeding it, and it's unwholesome, it's going to come right back around. You're going to be right back in the same.
Yeah, yeah, that was the of that reading that I did from Kittisaro on the Ajahn Chah day, where Ajahn Chah kept sort of prodding him, you know, so you're going to do your degree in Aldous Huxley, and you know, and then what? And then what? And then what? And then he started, you know, tracing his finger around the rim of the spittoon. just going and going. There's no end to this.
I'm thinking about the striving without getting tense and grim, and
that's what a concept, eh?
And one tip I've heard is to have a try to cultivate a sense of humor, and I was wondering if you had any other tips, like practical tips that you found useful.
Well, that's where I find mindfulness of the body so important. Because you feel it in your body. I mean, tense and grim is tense and grim. It's just like this. I say, oh, okay. Oh, wow, okay. Yeah, I can do this, and I can put forward. I can enjoy the effort, and it's this feels really good. You know, so it's not that that we immediately internalize and express in our body. So I find that body awareness really, really helpful. Is there any place where I'm really tightening up and tensing and holding really being able to tune in? A sense of holding it lightly, holding it with a sense of humor and a sense of irony. I think of many of the the observations that Ajahn Chah makes that are so strike, and the Buddha as well. They're just sort of observations of life or being a human, where one sees the absurdity or the ridiculousness of it, and not holding it tightly, not taking it too seriously.
I was listening the other day to a talk you were giving, and you mentioned Rinpoche Sumedho brought back a wooden, I think carved, Buddha Rupa from England.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, Ajahn Chah was really quick on stuff like that. And it was actually cast. If I remember correctly, I think it was actually cast. It was made and that was Ajahn Sumedho's very first visit coming back from England, and it's an image about, you know, so high, about a foot high or something. But it was, yeah, it was kind of tight and tense. It was sort of, Ajahn Chah kept looking over at it and sort of smiling. Finally, he first said, "Well, that's really a Furung Buddha, isn't it?" It's not really. It's really tight.
What comes to mind for me is Ajahn Sucitto said it in regard to the elements about, I can't remember in the context, but about just feeling the sense of water washing through you as a way of kind of. And also, you mentioned in one of your talks a long time ago, somebody asked, I think it was a Kukesari brother or something, got really concentrated very fast by imagining water like cool.
Yeah, I mean, he would, he what in his mind, all he would do. Like he wasn't it's a whole generation ago, before there was any real meditation available, and he just sort of remembered a few things from his childhood. And then, but he realized that meditation was something good, because he finished his schooling in Australia, and then he grew up in Thailand, and then finished his schooling and stayed on, and I'm getting, raising a family. But he realized that meditation was something good to incorporate into his life, and he would just. He would sit quietly, and then and his object for would be to just to visualize drinking a glass of water, and just to bringing the water into his body, and drinking that, just this cool water coming in, and. That'd be enough for him to enter concentration. There. Their mother was a meditator and practitioner. Trained them from the time they were quite little. Gave them opportunity to be exposed. But yeah, Kesari's mother used to... she would walk into, before there was a road into Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, before there was even a road, there was going to be about 10 kilometers, 7, 8 kilometers off the highway. 7, 8 kilometers, huh?
It's pretty far.
Yeah, it's not beside the road. Yeah, it's there's the main highway.
From the highway.
Huh? There was no road then, no. There's no road from the highway. There was the highway, main highway that goes up there. That's the Friendship Highway going. And it's about 7, 8, 10 kilometers off that road. And she started going to visit Ajahn Mahabua, walking in a long time ago. She also, from time to time, when she'd be meditating or practicing or chanting, would have relics appearing around her. And she was a special person.
And my